Back at it for you, kicking off a brand new week on Monday, the 20th of July, 2020, right here on Connecticut Today. Joe Scully from the Motor Transport Association joined us in the 3 p.m. hour. He gave us an update on how truckers are dealing with COVID-19, and he also added his opinion on a possible mandate that will come down in the next few decades as to the sale of electric trucks here in Connecticut. In the 4 o'clock hour, Governor Ned Lamont gave us a coronavirus briefing. During that briefing, the governor dealing with a possible $1,000 fine for people who don't follow Connecticut's quarantine rules. And he also updated the plan to reopen Connecticut's schools. Our buddy here right now, Joe Scully, who heads the MTAC, the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, representing folks, large and small businesses who have trucks and rely on trucks. Joe, how are you?
Paul, I'm good. Thank you for having me back.
Well, appreciate it, Joe. And I wanted to have you back, one, to just see what the deal is with you truckers still going on through the coronavirus pandemic here. But you sent me this a couple of days ago, and it's interesting. Your organization has put out an official response to a plan, and you're going to have to brief us, Joe, here as to whether this is in theory or this is going to happen, a plan to mandate. Now, it's not going to happen around the corner, but, you know, these things have a tendency to sneak up on people. Mandate electrification of trucks here in Connecticut. What's that all about, Joe?
Yeah, exactly. So Connecticut and several other states, some along the East Coast and some out West, put together a memorandum of understanding. So I guess the silver lining right now is that this thing has no force of law and it's just a concept, but it easily could become law, which I think would be a terrible thing, which is to mandate that come many years from now, 100%, every single commercial heavy-duty truck sold will have to be electric. And they've also got an interim date. So by 2030, they want to have, 30% of all new truck sales be electric. That concerns me because not all states would be mandated to follow this, but Connecticut and maybe some of its neighbors would. Now, this is a new technology that quite honestly doesn't really even exist yet. I mean, you could not go buy an electric tractor trailer. They just don't exist. But what we do know when things like this happen are the new technologies are very expensive, and it's hard for small businesses to deal with a big new expense like that beyond the typical cost of buying a new truck. So I think what it's going to do, if you have some states doing this and some states not, it's probably going to push truck sales out of state. Because businesses are going to strive for the more affordable truck, and that's going to put businesses here in Connecticut at a competitive disadvantage if it goes forward like this.
And, you know, Joe, I always kind of roll my eyes and think of exactly what you said. Well, they're going to mandate that a certain percentage of trucks, and it's closer than you think. 2050 is the far out date, but as you said, 2030 is only 10 years away. They're going to mandate that a certain percentage of trucks be sold a certain way, electric or whatever, zero polluting. Well, how exactly do you do that, Joe? I mean, if I'm a company or you're a company owner who wants to buy a fleet, I mean, are you forced to get a certain truck or not? I don't quite understand that.
No, and you're not alone. It's weird. It's almost like it's like a naked mandate, right? They're telling the manufacturers, you have to sell, 30% of your sales have to be electric, but they're not mandating that anybody buy them. Now, for the record, we have no objection to the concept of electric trucks. If a business wants to go out and buy an electric truck, go for it. It's this mandate that doesn't appear to be based on anything other than nice round numbers, 100% by 2050 and 30% by 2030, that there are signs in the documents that have been put out that they have no idea if it's going to work or not. Like, for example, come 2025, all the states are going to get together and reevaluate to see if the interim goals are achievable. They don't know if this can work or not, which is why you shouldn't be doing stuff like this. A very important thing for the trucking industry, we're interstate. We cross state lines. We go anywhere the product needs to go, wherever the customer needs to receive it. we need standards set by the federal government, which, by the way, there have been a slew of over the last 20 years, and there's more coming, and there's more in development. So it just bugs me a little bit when you have some state departments of environmental protection just coming after the trucking industry, I think, because it's a popular target, acting like nothing's been done. No, trucks are 98% cleaner in terms of particulate matter and sulfur content in the fuel and things like that over the last 20 years. And we're cutting NOx and we're cutting CO2 emissions. And every generation of the new diesel-powered truck is cleaner than it was before.
And Joe, it's interesting that we're talking about trucks here now. People don't understand. Listen, you know, it's great that your neighbor has a Prius or an Insight or some great hybrid or a Tesla. Guy I was talking to the other day at my local library, he's got the sport model Tesla. You know, 0 to 60, he said, in about 3.5 seconds because of that torque. But, Joe, you know as well as I do, having electric motors, you know, pulling a 3,000-pound car is a little different than relying on electric motors, even 10 years out, Joe, of pulling or pushing a 40 or 50,000-pound truck.
Well, and there are so many problems that come along with what you just said. We don't know how long it's going to take to charge a tractor trailer on a battery. Right now, there's no infrastructure for it. There are no charging stations. The range of these trucks, we don't know either. So are you going to be able to make it from one charging station to the next? And if you do, how long are you going to be stuck there? There are just so many unknowns for a mandate like this to be out there, we've got to do some feasibility studies or something again, because I don't have anything to say that this is based on feasibility. I think it's just flashy stuff that is put out there for public consumption, unfortunately.
And I noticed you also included a figure, Joe, from the American Transportation Research Institute about how much highway fuel consumption is accounted for by trucks. It's not that much.
Yeah, I've got a few data points out there. I think that one was like there's 100 billion fewer gallons of fuel used by trucking compared to passenger cars. And I guess my overall theme was, if one wants to talk about fuel use and emissions and congestion and all that stuff, the number one factor is cars. Now, I'm not anti-car. I'm pro-car. I love driving. But let's just not pick on the trucking industry because it's a popular target. And in fact, this MOU even admits that trucks are the second thing on the list. And number one is cars, right? And one of the data points I put out there in terms of where do mobile emissions come from, 88% come from gasoline-powered vehicles, so cars, and 2% come from trucks. I mean, wow. Really, is it worth it to start shaking up one of the backbones of the economy for 2% of the source of emissions? I don't think so. We've got to be smart about how we do this.
Joe Scully is the guest. Joe, hang on. I'm going to come back, talk to you about the general trucking industry, the state of such, employment, COVID-19, and all that. Hang on. Joe Scully from the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut. We like to have him on every so often. Paying salute to all the companies that use trucks out there and all the truckers, the men and women who keep the food on the table and everything you need for your home or your office coming on a daily basis. Traffic and weather together. 316 on WICC. And we spent a few more minutes with Joe Scully, who heads the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, representing businesses who own and operate their establishments with trucks, some of them one or two trucks, others with major fleets out there. And Joe, how has your business, or your members, I should say, how have they been faring during the COVID-19 outbreak? I know we chatted, I think, right at the beginning of this as all the rules were being laid out there. How the men and women fared, Joe, in dealing with all of these rules during the pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, it can vary from one business to another, but I think I would say generally that we're doing okay. You know, one of the things that happened was state and federal governments identified what they called essential businesses, right? Businesses that had to keep operating even as others shut down. Otherwise, our economy and our society would be at great risk. And so trucking was recognized by this state of Connecticut, so credit for that, and also the federal government as being essential. So our folks have continued to operate while putting in place safety practices and complying with everything, you know, the state and the CDC says. That doesn't mean it's all perfectly fine. I mean, when you have, for example, restaurants not allowed to operate, well, if you're a trucking company that delivers to a restaurant, you're in a tough spot there. So some have done well, some have seen a drop in business, and there are probably others that are really, really struggling because their end user customer has just not been allowed to operate.
And that's interesting because I didn't think about that, Joe, until you just mentioned it. People might think of the restaurant, of course, being the end user. Okay, the restaurant's closed for a couple of months. What's the big deal? But, yeah, if one of your member businesses doesn't have to deliver there, that's kind of almost a trickle up kind of effect in that situation.
It is, yeah. If there's no demand, whether that happens naturally or unnaturally, shall we say, because of forced closures, you know, that goes up the chain to us. And usually we think of, you know, trucking as being an indicator of upcoming economic activity, whether for better or for worse. If we see trucking jobs and freight tonnage being moved and everything trending upwards, that means there's good news coming, or conversely downwards, that means bad news is coming. But this time it kind of just, you know, you got cut off at the pass with the, you know, under the restaurant example, them being shut down. So then it flowed back up into the system to the trucking companies that serve those type of businesses.
Yep. And finally, Joe, you kind of touched on what I wanted to end with, employment in the trucking industry. Now, there are people who may not be able to go back to work yet, maybe stuck at home. They haven't been called back yet, although Connecticut is doing pretty well. What's the job outlook like, Joe, if you know anything regarding folks who may be looking for a career change? Are the trucking companies hiring or not?
No, some of them are. Look, at the start of this, I know the companies that were serving grocery stores were doing very well. I was also told that if you're a trucking company that served a large, you know, home improvement store, so Home Depot or Lowe's, that there was a lot of demand there and they were doing well. So there are jobs to be had. And kind of further to that point, we have some commercial driver's license training schools that are members. And I know that they have students going through their program, taking the CDL test and going to work in the trucking industry. So, again, I think we're blessed in that regard. We're probably faring a bit better than some other businesses. And you could find a job in the trucking industry right now if you search hard and are ready to work hard.
Yeah, you know, listen, before I come in here every day, I'm in here about noon, 1 o'clock before the show. I've got plenty of time in the morning, Joe. I could, you know, I could hop into a big rig and do 8 or 9 hours before
there you go.
Before I could park my rig in the back and I'll be all set. The website, mtac.us. It's the Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, mtac.us. And the boss there is Joe Scully. Joe, as always, thank you. We'll check in a few months down the line. Be good.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. There you go. The Motor Transport Association of Connecticut, mtac.us. Imagine that if I was a long-haul trucker before the show here. Oh, man.
Dr. Coe's been with us before as we continue to lead with science and public health as we talk about this pandemic and, in particular, our schools. I thought it was an appropriate time for Dr. Coe to be here and Miguel Cardona, since it's in about the end of this week, to be exact, that we've asked all of our superintendents across the state to respond to the protocols that we gave them on how you can think about reopening your schools safely. They're going to give us their feedback. And we just thought Miguel would have an opportunity, our Commissioner of Education, to answer a few of the frequently asked questions as we lead up to that. Just quickly, our COVID-19 daily summary. The numbers are all trending, blessedly, in the right direction still. We've done 27,000 tests. This is over the last 3 days, by the way. And that's a 0.6% positivity rate. That's the number of people who tested positive for COVID. Again, that's one of the lowest in the country. Sadly, 10 more fatalities, but 12 fewer hospitalizations. And I think you see from some of the numbers we showed you in other states, those states that are really infected, you see that they're reaching capacity in a number of their ICUs and a number of their hospitals. And thankfully, we're in a very different situation here. This next chart is a little misleading, because when they, Josh first showed it to me, I said, oh my God, why are we still in the red zone up there? But what you should know is this is a chart that was put together by the New York Times that shows where you're likely to be wearing the mask. The darker the red, the more likely you are to be wearing a mask. And every place we go, the number one factor in terms of influencing, reducing the spread is wearing the mask. So you can certainly see in that tiny corner of the Northeast that we are one of the darkest reds up there, Connecticut. Thank you very much. And I think you can see the rest of the state where people, rest of the country where people are likely to wear the mask and where they're not likely to wear the mask. And then we broke out the state of Connecticut. Again, the darker the red, the more likely you are to have social distancing and wearing the mask. I think you can see a little lighter in some of our cities, Bridgeport, New Haven, Hartford. So just a reminder that these are places where you can be safe. And by the way, Eastern Connecticut there, where there is a very, very low infection rate. I will tell you that we just got off the teleconference with Vice President Pence's task force, which is, you know, pretty helpful. I was very happy to see Dr. Fauci was back, by the way, able to answer questions. Again, he said, what is working in these highly infected states now is the fact that they are, have not allowed bars to, they've closed down bars, something we never opened. They're mandating masks for the first time, something we did months ago, of course. And finally, they're trying to keep occupancy low in the restaurants. We're at 50%. So these states are, they're not yet bending the curve, but they may not be going up as fast as they were a couple weeks ago. These are the four states that represent 50% of all the infections in this country right now. You know, Florida, Texas, Arizona, and California, which is really Southern California. So what they're doing is what Connecticut has been doing. And it does make a difference. I mean, I was interested in the COVID task force from the White House. They pointed out that if we have about 17 infections per 100,000 population in our state, the average across the country is 140 infections per 100,000. That's across the country. That includes even some of those lower infected places as well. So it shows you what an enormous difference. And in terms of positivity, the number of people who test positive, if we're a little less than 1%, I think we're at 0.8%, Josh tells me, over the last you know, week or two. The average across the country is 9%, you know, more than nine times ours. So it tells you, A, the impact of wearing the mask and the social distancing, and what a difference it has made in a state like ours. This next chart they also shared with us, they're able to collect a lot of data now that we didn't really have several months ago. And this is just the Connecticut mobility trend. And what they're doing is tracking smartphones. And you can see what happened in early March, mid-March, as COVID hit, the reports came out, and there really was a shutdown. You see how close we got to very little transportation as reflected by the mobility of the phones. And you've seen how over the last five, six, 7 weeks, it is trending back up again. But thankfully, as it trends back up, there's not necessarily an increase in infections in our state as yet, but it's just a fair warning out there. I will tell you that we are watching this like a hawk, And they did report in the White House task force that Maryland and Delaware, especially along the beaches in Virginia, are beginning to see some flare-ups. So it's not simply down there in those Sun Belt states. So that reminds me, as I get to this last chart here, that we are going to continue to tighten up on our quarantine on out-of-state travel. I think you know that any of those states that have more than a 10% positivity rate, which is a majority of the states right now, are on a quarantine. And obviously, we have noticed airlines, we've noticed travel agents informing hotels, these are the rules. You must quarantine for 14 days as you come to our state. And what we wanted to do was tighten that up a little bit in terms of what we're telling people to do. So we're going to give you an online travel health form. What does that mean? That means that airlines, travel agents will tell you this is a form you have to fill out before you fly to Connecticut. And we're working with New Jersey and Massachusetts and New York as well, so they can do the same thing. And hopefully that is filled out by the time you land and get to that location. An online travel form, by the way, impacts however you come into our state. You could be driving into the state. You could have rented a car and are coming to the state. You'll be still noticed and held accountable there. We're going to have members of our public health department there at Bradley Airport. This is something they're doing in LaGuardia and Kennedy as well. Just to ask people, you've filled out the form. We'd like to see the form as it's filled out and hold people accountable there. And we know how to contact them going forward. And we are giving a right or an option of having a $1,000 fine for people who refuse to fill out the form or don't obey the protocols. You know, enforcement of that will evolve over time, but we want to send the message loud and clear that as you look at the incredible infection rates in other parts of the country, we know that, you know, COVID came to this part of the country by airplane, and we don't want it to come by airplane again. So we're being particularly strict about how we do that going forward. You know, with that, Dr. Koh is here to answer any questions you may have, you know, as regards where we've been. And I'd just like to ask Miguel Cordon, our Commissioner of Education, just to say a few words with 5 days to go before our superintendents provide their best way to reopen schools. Miguel?
Sure. Thank you, Governor. Glad to be here with you all. You know, I just want to say that over the last month, the superintendents have been working really hard with their teams to establish plans for their districts. And, you know, I want to commend what I'm hearing throughout the communities where we have teachers, parents, board members all coming together. There's processes for local plans to be vetted publicly. And I think that that's critically important that people understand that the people that are going to be in the schools with your children are making these decisions along with the superintendents and the folks that are running the district. So thank you to the districts, to the superintendents, and all of you who have contributed in some form in the development of the plan in your local community. I want to share that we're continuing our work with the districts to plan for full reopening, knowing that the full reopening plan that allows for students to come in 5 days a week also has a hybrid option. For any family, any parent who feels that they're not ready to send their children to school in person, they have that option. So even with our full operation, there is that hybrid option for families to keep their children learning from home, and we're working on that. There's the other hybrid version where students might be coming to school on a limited basis, so maybe two or three times a week. That's a second plan that districts are working to develop in the event that the transmission increases. And then lastly, the remote. And we know that many students experience remote learning for the first time the last 3 months. We hope that the second round of it, all the work that's been done to plan it, will result in a better remote learning experience for the state of Connecticut. Although, you know, with very little notice, everyone stepped up. We've been discussing remote learning. I've gotten a lot of questions about what does it look like if a parent chooses to keep their children home? We're working along with partners from CAPS, CEA, and AFT to put together some guidance with their input on what that might look like, keeping in mind that we recognize if teachers have students in front of their during the day, we're not expecting a second shift teachers to have to meet the needs of the learners that are not in the schoolhouse. So that's not easy work, but that's something that we're committed to doing together. You know, another question, I get a lot of questions about safety. We are leading with safety in mind, not only the safety of students, but also of our staff, of our teachers, of our paraeducators, all of our folks in our building who are part of that school community. And then lastly, I get a lot of questions about resources. Well, you know, this is going to cost money. What does that look like? We were fortunate last week to hear from districts about what they anticipate to be some costs. And just this morning, we're having preliminary conversations with the Office of Policy Management and the governor's team to ensure that what we're hearing from districts is communicated to the governor, because I know the governor is committed also to making this work safely, and we're committed as well. Thank you, Governor.
Hey, Miguel, thank you very much. If I might, I just kick it off, Dr. Coe, with you with a broad question, if I could, which is it's been 6-plus weeks since you joined us. You devoted most of your professional life to studying infectious diseases. Anything surprise you regarding COVID over the last 6 weeks, what we hadn't expected?
Well, thank you very much, Governor, for the opportunity to come back, and it's surely a pleasure. Let me just, I think so. As we know from COVID, we're learning something always new, and we're always surprised each day and each week. I think one thing that's come out over the last week has been some information from Korea, where they're doing intensive contact tracing. And I think that kind of adds to some of our knowledge, particularly about the subject that Miguel had just talked about, was with about children and transmission among children, and you know, how this would affect, for example, if we're having kids go to school. So this, as we know, for diseases, very common diseases like influenza, school children, where infections with influenza virus are actually driven, the transmission in the community is driven by transmission among young children, especially the younger ones. But we didn't really have a good understanding about that in COVID. We always thought that maybe children may have a lower risk of not only getting COVID, but also, and not only getting, you know, getting the severe complications, but also a lower risk of transmitting it to people in their families. So they did, there's a big study from Korea where they're doing intensive contact tracing. They looked at transmission in households and how that, what was the risk among people who are contacts of different people of different ages. And what they found was that children between 10 to 19 years of age spread the virus just as high, and if not higher, than adults. And that makes it all the more important that the types of interventions that Miguel was just went through about how do we keep our schools safe, and what can we do in terms of alternative or contingency plans. Those are, you know, exceedingly important steps. And then also the precautions that we need to take at home, you know, for all people at home, and not just children, especially those that have multi-generational homes, where you have elderly people who are much more at risk for the severe complications.
All right, thank you, Dr. Coe. Over to you, Max.
Yes, this question is for Dr. Cardona, since we do have you here. We keep hearing from teachers who are scared to return to classrooms, and they're voicing their concern for social distancing. They watch these news conferences, they see the 6 feet distancing here, but they say that it's not been mandated yet in classrooms. What do you say to that?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the question too well. There was a big echo. Could someone repeat the question?
Yes, Dr. Cardona, we're looking to kind of hone in on social distancing in the classrooms, because we're hearing from the teachers who say that it's not yet been mandated in the classrooms yet. What do you say to them?
We do require, as part of the plan, several mitigation strategies. One of the most important ones is obviously the facial coverings. Social distancing also is a part of the plan, washing hands, cleaning the spaces, intense cleaning. So social distancing should be a part of the plan in every school. Plans are due this week, and we anticipate that all districts have looked at social distancing as one of those strategies that they use in combination with others. While it's true that in some places it's more difficult to maintain 6 feet, the expectation is that social distancing is a strategy that's used in all spaces.
And a question for the governor, is out-of-state vehicle traffic being monitored, and is there any indication as to, you know, if it's up right now?
No, there's no indication that it's up. And as we suggested, we wanted to make sure that we could at least get our forms in front of drivers as well as folks who fly into our state. Overwhelmingly, the out-of-staters from those infected states come by air, by the way. But those that maybe came in from LaGuardia, rented a car, they're going to have their information. They're going to have to fill out the form as well.
News 8.
Good afternoon, everyone. Governor, with respect to the false positives, what is the next step now? I know that the proper people have been identified, but in moving forward, there is another way to get positive tests reanalyzed just to make sure that that they are retested.
Yeah, I'll start on that and then maybe hand it over to Josh if I could. Perhaps you're thinking about the situations in the nursing home. I mean, the good news for us is we caught it. We had people take a second test. We're able to find those false negatives, I think they were. And that was very important in terms of track that, now be able to get those people properly tested and taken care of. Josh, anything else?
Yeah, that's correct. Just for a broader background for people who may not follow the press release that came out from the Department of Public Health earlier, our state public health lab caught late last week and over the weekend about 90 individuals who had false positives, so people who tested positive but were actually not positive with coronavirus, out of about 2,200 tests performed on a certain instrument that was just put into the public health lab about a month ago. So they've gone back, they've retested all those positive cases over the last month. 90 out of 144 individuals were false positives. So those people have all been notified, their clinicians have been notified, and our public health epidemiology team is working with each of them to figure out the right actions going forward. But I do want to thank our public health team for first spotting the issue and investigating it and notifying the FDA as well as the manufacturer and working to take all the necessary follow-up steps, including, as the governor said, having all those individuals retested. Most important message here for the general public, though, is this is a very small number of false positives over the course of a month. So if you have tested positive generally and you have not heard from your clinician, you should assume that it was a valid positive and accurate positive test and continue to follow the clinical advice to self-isolate as appropriate.
Well, for Dr. Cardona or anyone else, with this happening today or finding out about it at least, can that have an effect looking forward to the schools reopening, or would it take something a little bit different maybe to tap the brakes on that?
We're looking at overall transmission trends in Connecticut to make the decision. Actually, we have a team from the Department of Public Health working with folks from our agency to try to identify more clear thresholds. We're monitoring everything, not only the transmission rates, but also what we learn about COVID. I think those are the two things that influence our decisions. So as the more we learn, the more we are informed about the best path to move forward to provide school for students in a safe way.
NBC Connecticut.
Good afternoon, Governor. Regarding your new travel quarantine policy regarding the fine, how are you planning to enforce that when people leave the airport? And is it possible that someone could get tested before arriving or after to avoid the quarantine completely?
Yes, you can get tested and show that you tested negative. That's correct. But otherwise, I think it's one more way that we can remind people that we're taking this seriously. When we have to impose that fine, we'll see. No plans on that right now. But at least people know there's a possibility and there could be some penalties, so they'll be serious about taking the quarantine seriously.
And for Dr. Koh and perhaps Commissioner Cardona, regarding that South Korean study that seemed to show that older children are more likely to spread COVID than younger children, does that have implications for what grades reopen and how? Is the plan changed in any way due to that?
So we recognize, you know, when we developed the plan, we knew that facial coverings would be a critical component to it, and the use of facial coverings is a big part of the plan. It's something that, as the plan was being developed, you know, the data was, the research wasn't as clear as it is now, but we still were not sure, and we were not taking any chances. We felt facial coverings is something that has helped Connecticut get to where it is, and we know that that has to be the culture of our state as we're educating students so that we can reduce transmission. So while the study did not, you know, I learned about the study earlier today myself, while the study didn't change our plans, it reinforced the fact that we need to make sure that we're helping our students during the summer prepare for school with facial coverings as the norm. And that's a statewide effort. And we've been able to do well in Connecticut following those rules. I think we can do well reopening schools carefully.